again, and she staved the tears off grimly. She was Franny Goldsmith, Peter Goldsmith's daughter, and she wasn't going to sit in the parking lot of the Ogunquit Dairy Queen crying her damn stupid eyes out. "What do you want to do?" Jess asked, getting out his cigarettes. "What do you want to do?" He struck a light, and for just a moment, as cigarette smoke raftered up, she clearly saw a man and a boy fighting for control of the same face. "Oh, hell," he said. "The choices as I see them," she said. "We can get married and keep the baby. We can get married and give the baby up. Or we don't get married and I keep the baby. Or Franny. Or we don't get married and I don't keep the baby. Or I could get an abortion. Does that cover everything? Have I left anything out?" "Franny, can't we just talk?" "We are talking," she flashed at him. "You had your chance and you said, 'Oh, hell,' your exact words. I have just outlined all of the possible choices. Of course, I've had a little more time to work up an agenda." "You want a cigarette?" "No, they're bad for the baby." "Franny, goddammit!" "Why are you shouting?" she asked softly. "Because you seem determined to aggravate me as much as you can," Jess said hotly. He controlled himself. "I'm sorry, I just can't think of this as my fault." "You can't?" She looked at him with a cocked eyebrow. "And behold, a virgin shall conceive." "Do you have to be so goddamn flip? You had the pill, you said. I took you at your word. Was I so wrong?" "No, you weren't so wrong, but that doesn't change the fact." "I guess not," he said gloomily and pitched his cigarette out half-smoked. "So what do we do?" "You keep asking me, Jess. I just outlined the choices as I see them. I thought you might have some ideas. They're suicide, but I'm not considering it at this point. So pick the other choice you like and we'll talk about it." "Let's get married," he said in a sudden, strong voice. He had the air of a man who has decided the best way to solve the Gordian knot problem would be to hack right down through the middle of it, full speed ahead, and get the whiners below decks. "No," she said, "I don't want to marry you." It was as if his face was held together by a number of unseen bolts, and each of them had suddenly been loosened a turn and a half. Everything sagged at once. The image was so cruelly comical that she had to rub her wounded tongue against the rough top of her mouth to keep from getting the giggles again. She didn't want to laugh at Jess. "Why not?" he asked. "Fran, I have to think of my reasons why not. I'm not going to let you draw me into a discussion of my reasons why not, because right now I don't know." "You don't love me," he said sulkily. "In most cases, love and marriage are mutually exclusive states. Pick another choice." He was silent for a long time. He fiddled with a fresh cigarette, but didn't light it. At last he said, "I can't pick another choice, Franny, because you don't want to discuss this. You want to score points off me." That touched her a little bit. She nodded. "Maybe you're right. I've had a few scored off me in the last couple of weeks. Now you, Jess, you're Joe College all the way. If a mugger came at you with a knife, you'd want to convene a seminar on the spot." "Oh, for God's sake." "Pick another choice." "No, you've got your reasons all figured out. Maybe I need a little time to think, too." "Okay, would you take us back to the parking lot? I'll drop you off and do some errands." He gazed at her, startled. "Franny, I rode my bike all the way down from Portland. I've got a room at a motel outside of town. I thought we were going to spend the weekend together."
"In your motel room?"
"No, Jess, the situation has changed. You just get back on your 10-speed and bike back to Portland, and you get in touch when you've thought about it a little more. No great hurry."
"Stop riding me, Franny."
"No, Jess, you were the one who rode me," she jeered in sudden, furious anger. And that was when he slapped her lightly, backhand on the cheek. He stared at her, stunned.
"I'm sorry, Fran."
"Accepted," she said colorlessly. "Drive on." They didn't talk on the ride back to the public beach parking lot. She sat with her hands folded in her lap, watching the slices of ocean layered between the cottages just west of the seawall. They looked like slum apartments, she thought. Who owned these houses, most of them still shuttered blindly against the summer that would begin officially in less than a week? Professors from MIT, Boston doctors, New York lawyers. These houses weren't the real biggies, the coast estates owned by men who counted their fortunes in 7 and 8 figures. But when the families who owned them moved in here, the lowest IQ on Shore Road would be Gus, the parking attendant. The kids would have 10 speeds, like Jess's. They would have bored expressions, and they would go with their parents to have lobster dinners and to attend the Ogunquit Playhouse. They would idle up and down the main street, masquerading after soft summer twilight as street people. She kept looking out at the lovely flashes of cobalt between the crammed together houses, aware that the vision was blurring with a new film of tears, the little white cloud that cried. They reached the parking lot, and Gus waved. They waved back. "I'm sorry I hit you, Franny," Jess said in a subdued voice. "I never meant to do that."
"I know. Are you going back to Portland?"
"I'll stay here tonight and call you in the morning. But it's your decision, Fran. If you decide, you know, that an abortion is the thing, I'll scrape up the cash."
"Pun intended?"
"No," he said. "Not at all." He slid across the seat and kissed her chastely. "I love you, Fran."
"I don't believe you do," she thought. "Suddenly I don't believe it at all. But I'll accept in good grace. I can do that much."
"All right," she said quietly. "It's the Lighthouse Motel. Call if you want."
"Okay."
She slid behind the wheel, suddenly feeling very tired. Her tongue ached miserably where she had bitten it. He walked to where his bike was locked to the iron railing and coasted it back to her.
"Wish you'd call, Fran."
She smiled artificially.
"We'll see. So long, Jess."
She put the Volvo in gear, turned around, and drove across the lot to the Shore Road. She could see Jess standing by his bike yet, the ocean at his back, and for the second time that day she mentally accused him of knowing exactly what kind of picture he was making. This time, instead of being irritated, she felt a little bit sad. She drove on, wondering if the ocean would ever look the way it had looked to her before all of this had happened. Her tongue hurt miserably. She opened her window wider and spat. All white and all right this time. She could smell the salt of the ocean strongly, like bitter tears. Chapter 3 Norm Bruett woke up at 10:15 in the morning to the sound of kids fighting outside the bedroom window and country music from the radio in the kitchen. He went to the back door in his saggy shorts and undershirt, threw it open, and yelled, "You kids, shut your heads!" A moment's pause. Luke and Bobby looked around from the old and rusty dump truck they had been arguing over. As always, when he saw his kids, Norm felt dragged 2 ways at once. His heart ached to see them wearing hand-me-downs and Salvation Army give-outs like the ones you saw the nigger children in East Arnett wearing. And at the same time, a horrible shaking anger would sweep through him, making him want to stride out there and beat the living shit out of them.
"Yes, Daddy,"
Luke said in a subdued way. He was 9.
"Yes, Daddy,"
Bobby echoed. He was 7, going on 8. Norm stood for a moment, glaring at them, and slammed the door shut. He stood for a moment, looking indecisively at the pile of clothes he had worn yesterday. They were lying at the foot of the sagging double bed where he had dropped them. "That slutty bitch," he thought. "She didn't even hang up my duds."
"Lila!" he bawled.
There was no answer. He considered ripping the door open again and asking Luke where the hell she had gone. It wasn't Donated Commodities Day until next week, and if she was down at the employment office in Braintree again, she was an even bigger fool than he thought. He didn't bother to ask the kids. He felt tired, and he had a queasy, thumping headache. Felt like a hangover, but he'd only had 3 beers down at Haps the night before. That accident had been a hell of a thing. The woman and the baby dead in the car, the man Campion dying on the way to the hospital. By the time Hap had gotten back, the state patrol had come and gone, and the wrecker and the Braintree Undertaker's hack. Vic Palfrey had given the laws a statement for all 5 of them. The undertaker, who was also the county coroner, refused to speculate on what might have hit them.
"But it ain't cholera, and don't you go scaring people saying it is. There'll be an autopsy and you can read about it in the paper."
Miserable little pissant, Norm thought, slowly dressing himself in yesterday's clothes. His headache was turning into a real blinder.
Those kids had better be quiet or they were going to have a pair of broken arms to mouth off about. Why the hell couldn't they have school the whole year round? He considered tucking his shirt into his pants, decided the president probably wouldn't be stopping by that day, and shuffled out into the kitchen in his sock feet. The bright sunlight coming in the east windows made him squint. The cracked Philco radio over the stove sang, "But baby, you can tell me if anyone can. Baby, can you dig your man? He's a righteous man. Tell me, baby, can you dig your man?" Things had come to a pretty pass when they had to play nigger rock and roll music like that on the local country music station. Norm turned it off before it could split his head. There was a note by the radio, and he picked it up, narrowing his eyes to read it. "Dear Norm, Sally Hodges says she needs somebody to sit her kids this morning and says she'll give me a dollar. I'll be back for lunch. There's sausage if you want it. I love you, honey. Lila." Norm put the note back and just stood there for a moment, thinking it over and trying to get the sense of it in his mind. It was goddamn hard to think past the headache. Babysitting. A dollar. For Ralph Hodges' wife. The three elements slowly came together in his mind. Lila had gone off to sit Sally Hodges' three kids to earn a lousy dollar and had stuck him with Luke and Bobby. By God, it was hard times when a man had to sit home and wipe his kids' noses so his wife could go and scratch out a lousy buck that wouldn't even buy them a gallon of gas. That was hard fucking times. Dull anger came to him, making his head ache even worse. He shuffled slowly to the Frigidaire, bought when he had been making good overtime, and opened it. Most of the shelves were empty, except for leftovers Lila had put up in refrigerator dishes. He hated those little plastic Tupperware dishes. Old beans, old corn, a leftover dab of chili. Nothing a man liked to eat. Nothing in there but little Tupperware dishes and three little old sausages done up in handy wrap. He bent, looking at them, the familiar helpless anger now compounded by the dull throb in his head. Those sausages looked like somebody had cut the cocks off in three of those pygmies they had down in Africa or South America, or wherever the fuck it was they had them. He didn't feel like eating anyway. He felt damn sick when he got right down to it. He went over to the stove, scratched a match on the piece of sandpaper nailed to the wall beside it, lit the front gas ring, and put on the coffee. Then he sat down and waited dully for it to boil. Just before it did, he had to scramble his snot rag out of his back pocket to catch a big wet sneeze. Coming down with a cold, he thought. Isn't that something nice on top of everything else? But it never occurred to him to think of the phlegm that had been running out of that fellow Campion's pump the night before. Hap was in the garage bay putting a new tailpipe on Tony Leominster's Scout, and Vic Palfrey was rocking back on a folding camp chair, watching him and drinking a Dr. Pepper, when the bell dinged out front. Vic squinted. "It's the state patrol," he said. "Looks like your cousin there, Joe Bob." "Okay." Hap came out from beneath the Scout, wiping his hands on a ball of waste. On his way through the office, he sneezed heavily. He hated summer colds. They were the worst. Joe Bob Brentwood, who was almost 6.5 feet tall, was standing by the back of his cruiser, filling up. Beyond him, the three pumps Campion had driven over the night before were neatly lined up like dead soldiers. "Hey, Joe Bob," Hap said, coming out. "Hap, you son bitch," Joe Bob said, putting the pump handle on automatic and stepping over the hose. "You lucky this place still standing this morning." "Shit, Stu Redmond saw the guy coming and switched off the pumps. There was a load of sparks, though." "Still damn lucky. Listen, Hap, I come over for something besides a fill-up." "Yeah?" Joe Bob's eyes went to Vic, who was standing in the station door. "Was that old geezer here last night?"
"Who, Vic?"
"Yeah, he comes over most every night."
"Can he keep his mouth shut?"
"Sure, I reckon. He's a good enough old boy."
The automatic feed kicked off. Hap squeezed off another 20 cents worth and put the nozzle back on the pump and switched it off. He walked back to Joe Bob.
"So, what's the story?"
"Well, let's go inside. I guess the old fella ought to hear, too. And if you get a chance, you can phone the rest of them that was here."
They walked across the tarmac and into the office.
"A good morning to you, officer," Vic said.
Joe Bob nodded. Coffee, Joe Bob? Hap asked.
I guess not.
He looked at them heavily.
Thing is, I don't know how my superiors would like me being here at all. I don't think they would. So when those guys come here, you don't let them know I tipped you, right?
What guys, officer? Vic asked.
Health department guys, Joe Bob said.
Vic said, oh, Jesus, it was, Collar, I knowed it was.
Hap looked from one to the other.
Joe Bob?
I don't know nothing, Joe Bob said, sitting down in one of the plastic woolco chairs.
His bony knees came nearly up to his neck. He took a pack of Chesterfields from his blouse pocket and lit up.
Finnegan there, the coroner.
That was a smartass, Hap said fiercely. You should have seen him strutting around in here, Joe Bob, just like a pea turkey that got his first hard on, shushing people and all that.
He's a big turd in a little bowl, all right, Joe Bob agreed. Well, he got Dr. James to look at this Campion, and the two of them called in another doctor that I don't know. Then they got on the phone to Houston, and around 3 this morning, they come into that little airport outside of Braintree.
Who did?
Pathologists, 3 of them. They were in there with the bodies until about 8 o'clock. Cutting on them is my guess, though I don't know for sure. Then they got on the phone to the plague center in Atlanta, and those guys are going to be here this afternoon. But they said in the meantime that the state health department was to send some fellows out here and see all the guys that were in the station last night, and the guys that drove the rescue unit to Braintree. I don't know, but it sounds to me like they want you quarantined.
Moses and the bulrushes, Hap said, frightened.
The Atlanta Plague Center's federal, Vic said. Why would they send out a plane load of federal men just for cholera?
Search me, Joe Bob said. But I thought you guys had a right to know. From all I hear, you just tried to lend a hand.
It's appreciated, Joe Bob, Hap said slowly. What did James and this other doctor say?
Not much, but they look scared. I never seen doctors look scared like that. I didn't much care for it.
A heavy silence fell. Joe Bob went to the drink machine and got a bottle of Fresca. The faint hissing sound of carbonation was audible as he popped the cap. As Joe Bob sat down again, Hap took a Kleenex from the box next to the cash register, wiped his runny nose, and folded it into the pocket of his greasy overall.
"What have you found out about Campion?" Vic asked.
"Anything?"
"We're still checking," Joe Bob said with a trace of importance. "His ID says he was from San Diego, but a lot of the stuff in his wallet was 2 and 3 years out of date. His driver's license was expired. He had a Bank America card that was issued in 1986, and that was expired, too. He had an Army card, so we're checking with them. The captain has a hunch that Campion hadn't lived in San Diego for maybe 4 years.
"AWOL?"
Vic asked. He produced a big red bandana, hawked, and spat into it.
"Dunno yet. But his Army card said he was in until 1997, and he was in civvies, and he was with his family, and he was a fuck of a long way from California. And listen to my mouth run."
"Well, I'll get in touch with others and tell them what you said anyway," Hap said. "Much obliged."
Joe Bob stood up. "Sure, just keep my name out of it. I sure wouldn't want to lose my job. Your buddies don't need to know who tipped you, do they?"
"No," Hap said, and Vic echoed it.
As Joe Bob went to the door, Hap said a little apologetically,
"That's 5 even for gas, Joe Bob. I hate to charge you, but with things the way they are, that's okay."
Joe Bob handed him a credit card.
"State's paying, and I got my credit slip to show why I was here."
While Hap was filling out the slip, he sneezed twice.
"You want to watch that," Joe Bob said. "Nothing any worse than a summer cold."
"Don't I know it."
Suddenly, from behind them, Vic said,
"Maybe it ain't a cold."
They turned it to him. Vic looked frightened.
"I woke up this morning sneezing and hacking away like 60, Vic said. "Had a mean headache, too. I took some aspirins and it's gone back some, but I'm still full of snot.
Maybe we're coming down with it, what that Campion had. What he died of."
Hap looked at him for a long time, and as he was about to put forward all his reasons why it couldn't be, he sneezed again. Joe Bob looked at them both gravely for a moment and then said,
"You know, it might not be such a bad idea to close the station, Hap. Just for today."
Hap looked at him, scared, and tried to remember what all his reasons had been. He couldn't think of a one.
All he could remember was that he had also awakened with a headache and a runny nose. Well, everyone caught a cold once in a while. But before that guy Campion had shown up, he had been fine. Just fine. The three Hodges kids were 6, 4, and 18 months. The two youngest were taking naps, and the oldest was out back digging a hole. Lila Bruett was in the living room watching The Young and the Restless. She hoped Sally wouldn't return until it was over. Ralph Hodges had bought a big color TV when times had been better in Arnett, and Lila loved to watch the afternoon stories in color. Everything was so much prettier. She drew on her cigarette and then let the smoke out in spasms as a racking cough seized her. She went into the kitchen and spat the mouthful of crap she had brought up down the drain. She had gotten up with the cough, and all day it had felt like someone was tickling the back of her throat with a feather. She went back to the living room after taking a peek out the pantry window to make sure Bert Hodges was okay. A commercial was on now, 2 dancing bottles of toilet bowl cleaner. Lila let her eyes drift around the room and wished her own house looked this nice. Sally's hobby was doing paint-by-the-numbers pictures of Christ, and they were all over the living room in nice frames. She especially liked the big one of the Last Supper mounted in back of the TV. It had come with 60 different oil colors, Sally had told her, and it took almost 3 months to finish. It was a real work of art. Just as her story came back on, baby Cheryl started to cry, a whooping, ugly yell broken by bursts of coughing. Lila put out her cigarette and hurried into the bedroom. Eva, the 4-year-old, was still fast asleep, but Cheryl was lying on her back in her crib, and her face was going an alarming purple color. Her cries began to sound strangled. Lila, who was not afraid of the croup after seeing both of her own through bouts with it, picked her up by the heels and swatted her firmly on the back. She had no idea if Dr. Spock recommended this sort of treatment or not, because she had never read him. It worked nicely on baby Cheryl. She emitted a froggy croak and suddenly spat an amazing wad of yellow phlegm out onto the floor. "Better?" Lila asked.
"Yes," said baby Cheryl.
She was almost asleep again. Lila wiped up the mess with a Kleenex. She couldn't remember ever having seen a baby cough up so much snot all at once. She sat down in front of The Young and the Restless again, frowning. She lit another cigarette, sneezed over the first puff, and then began to cough herself. Chapter 4 It was an hour past nightfall. Starkey sat alone at a long table, sifting through sheets of yellow flimsy. Their contents dismayed him. He had been serving his country for 36 years, beginning as a scared West Point plebe. He had won medals. He had spoken with presidents, had offered them advice, and on occasion his advice had been taken. He had been through dark moments before, plenty of them. But this... He was scared. So deeply scared he hardly dared admit it to himself. It was the kind of fear that could drive you mad. On impulse, he got up and went to the wall where the 5 blank TV monitors looked into the room. As he got up, his knee bumped the table, causing one of the sheets of flimsy to fall off the edge. It seesawed lazily down through the mechanically purified air and landed on the tile, half in the table's shadow and half out. Someone standing over it and looking down would have seen this. OT confirmed. Seems reasonably strain coded A48-AB. Campion, W, Sally, antigen shift and mutation. High risk, excess mortality, and communicability estimated repeat 99.4%. Atlanta Plague Center understands. Top secret blue folder. Ends. PT-222-312-A. Starkey pushed a button under the middle screen, and the picture flashed on with the unnerving suddenness of solid-state components. It showed the Western California desert looking east. It was desolate, and the desolation was rendered eerie by the reddish-purple tinge of infrared photography. It's out there, straight ahead, Starkey thought. Project Blue. The fright tried to wash over him again. He reached down into his pocket and brought out a blue pill, what his daughter would call a downer. Names didn't matter, results did. He dry-swallowed it, his hard, unseen face wrinkling for a moment as it went down. Project Blue, He looked at the other blank monitors and then punched up pictures on all of them. 4 and 5 showed labs. 4 was physics. 5 was viral biology. The Vi-Bi lab was full of animal cages, mostly for guinea pigs, rhesus monkeys, and a few dogs. None of them appeared to be sleeping. In the physics lab, a small centrifuge was still turning around and around. Starkey had complained about that. He had complained bitterly. There was something spooky about that centrifuge whirling gaily around and around and around, while Dr. Eswick lay dead on the floor nearby, sprawled out like a scarecrow that had tipped over in a high wind. They had explained to him that the centrifuge was on the same circuit as the lights, and if they turned off the centrifuge, the lights would go too. And the cameras down there were not equipped for infrared. Starkey understood. Some more brass might come down from Washington and want to look at the dead Nobel Prize winner who was lying 400 feet under the desert, less than a mile away. If we turn off the centrifuge, we turn off the professor. Elementary. What his daughter would have called a catch-22. He took another downer and looked into Monitor 2. This was the one he liked least of all. He didn't like the man with his face in the soup. Suppose someone walked up to you and said, "You will spend eternity with your fizz in a bowl of soup." It's like the old pie-in-the-face routine. It stops being funny when it starts being you. Monitor 2 showed the Project Blue cafeteria. The accident had occurred almost perfectly between shifts, and the cafeteria had been only lightly populated. He supposed it hadn't mattered much to them whether they had died in the cafeteria or in their bedrooms or their labs. Still, the man with his face in the soup. A man and a woman in blue coveralls were crumpled at the foot of the candy machine. A man in a white coverall lay beside the Seaberg jukebox. At the tables themselves were 9 men and 14 women, some of them slumped beside hostess Twinkies, some with spilled cups of Coke and Sprite still clutched in their stiff hands. And at the second table, near the end, there was a man who had been identified as Frank D. Bruce. His face was in a bowl of what appeared to be Campbell's chunky sirloin soup. The first monitor showed only a digital clock. Until June 13th, all the numbers on that clock had been green. Now they had turned bright red. They had stopped. The figures read 06-1390, 02-37-16. June 13th, 1990, 2:37 in the morning, and 16 seconds. From behind him came a brief burring noise. Starkey turned off the monitors one by one and then turned around. He saw the sheet of flimsy on the floor and put it back on the table. "Come." It was Creighton. He looked grave and his skin was a slaty color. More bad news, Starkey thought serenely. Someone else has taken a long high dive into a cold bowl of chunky sirloin soup. "Hi, Len," he said quietly. Len Creighton nodded. "Billy, this... Christ, I don't know how to tell you." "I think one word at a time might go best, soldier. Those men who handled Campion's body are through their prelims at Atlanta, and the news isn't good." "All of them?" "5 for sure. There's one. His name is Stuart Redman, who's negative so far. But as far as we can tell, Campion himself was negative for over 50 hours. "If only Campion hadn't run," Starkey said. "That was sloppy security, Len. Very sloppy." Creighton nodded. "Go on." "Arnett has been quarantined. We've isolated at least 16 cases of constantly shifting A-prime flu there so far. And those are just the overt ones." "The news media?" "So far, no problem. They believe it's anthrax." "What else?" "One very serious problem. We have a Texas highway patrolman named Joseph Robert Brentwood. His cousin owns the gas station where Campion ended up. He dropped by yesterday morning to tell Hapscom the health people were coming. We picked him up 3 hours ago, and he's en route to Atlanta now. In the meantime, he's been patrolling half of East Texas. God knows how many people he's been in contact with." "Oh, shit," Starkey said, and was appalled by the watery weakness in his voice and the skin crawl that had started near the base of his testicles and was now working up into his belly. 99.4% communicability, he thought. It played insanely over and over in his mind. And that meant 99.4% excess mortality, because the human body couldn't produce the antibodies necessary to stop a constantly shifting antigen virus. Every time the body did produce the right antibody, the virus simply shifted to a slightly new form. For the same reason, a vaccine was going to be almost impossible to create.
99.4%. Christ, he said. That's it?
Well, go on. Finish.
Softly then, Creighton said, Hammer's dead, Billy. Suicide. He shot himself in the eye with his service pistol. The Project Blue specs were on his desk. I guess he thought leaving them there was all the suicide note anybody would need.
Starkey closed his eyes. Vic Hammer was, had been, his son-in-law. How was he supposed to tell Cynthia about this?
I'm sorry, Cindy. Vic took a high dive into a cold bowl of soup today. Here, have a downer.
You see, there was a goof. Somebody made a mistake with a box. Somebody else forgot to pull a switch that would have sealed off the base. The lag was only 40-some seconds, but it was enough. The box is known in the trade as a sniffer. It's made in Portland, Oregon, Defense Department Contract 16448-0966. The boxes are put together in separate circuits by female technicians, and they do it that way so none of them really know what they're doing. One of them was maybe thinking about what to make for supper, and whoever was supposed to check her work was maybe thinking about trading the family car. Anyway, Cindy, the last coincidence was that a man at the number 4 security post, a man named Campion, saw the numbers go red just in time to get out of the room before the doors shut and maglocked. Then he got his family and ran. He drove through the main gate just 4 minutes before the sirens started going off and we sealed the whole base. And no one started looking for him until nearly an hour later, because there are no monitors in the security posts. Somewhere along the line, you have to stop guarding the guardians, or everyone in the world would be a goddamn turnkey. And everybody just assumed he was in there, waiting for the sniffers to sort out the clean areas from the dirty ones. So he got himself some running room, and he was smart enough to use the ranch trails, and lucky enough not to pick any of the ones where his car could get bogged down. Then someone had to make a command decision on whether or not to bring in the state police, the FBI, or both of them. And that fabled buck got passed hither, thither, and yon. And by the time someone decided the shop ought to handle it, this happy asshole, this happy diseased asshole, had gotten to Texas. And when they finally caught him, he wasn't running anymore because he and his wife and his baby daughter were all laid out on cooling boards in some pissant little town called Braintree. Braintree, Texas. Anyway, Cindy, what I'm trying to say is that this was a chain of coincidence on the order of winning the Irish sweepstakes. With a little incompetence thrown in for good luck. For bad luck, I mean, please excuse me. But mostly it was just a thing that happened. None of it was your man's fault, but he was the head of the project, and he saw the situation start to escalate, and then... Thanks, Len, he said.
Billy, would you like...
I'll be up in 10 minutes. I want you to schedule a general staff meeting 15 minutes from now. If they're in bed, kick 'em out.
Yes, sir.
And Len.
Yes?
I'm glad you were the one who told me.
Yes, sir.
Creighton left. Starkey glanced at his watch, then walked over to the monitors set into the wall. He turned on 2, put his hands behind his back, and stared thoughtfully into Project Blue's silent cafeteria.
Chapter 5. Larry Underwood pulled around the corner and found a parking space big enough for the Datsun Z between a fire hydrant and somebody's trash can that had fallen into the gutter. There was something unpleasant in the trash can, and Larry tried to tell himself that he really hadn't seen the stiffening dead cat and the rat gnawing at its white-furred belly. The rat was gone so fast from the sweep of his headlights that it really might not have been there. The cat, however, was fixed in stasis. And, he supposed, killing the Z's engine, if you believed in one, you had to believe in the other. Didn't they say that Paris had the biggest rat population in the world? All those old sewers. But New York did well, too. And if he remembered his misspent youth well enough, not all the rats in New York City went on 4 legs. And what the hell was he doing parked in front of this decaying brownstone, thinking about rats anyway? 5 days ago, on June 14th, he had been in sunny Southern California, home of hopheads, freak religions, the only country western nightclubs in the world with go-go dancers, and Disneyland.
This morning at 4:15 he had arrived on the shore of the other ocean, paying his toll to go across the Triborough Bridge. A sullen drizzle had been falling. Only in New York can an early summer drizzle seem so unrepentantly sullen. Larry could see the drops accreting on the Z's windshield now, as intimations of dawn began to creep into the eastern sky. Dear New York, I've come home. Maybe the Yankees were in town. That might make the whole trip worthwhile. Take the subway up to the stadium, drink beer, eat hot dogs, and watch the Yankees wallop the piss out of Cleveland or Boston. His thoughts drifted off, and when he wandered back to them, he saw that the light had gotten much stronger. The dashboard clock read 6:05. He had been dozing. The rat had been real, he saw. The rat was back. The rat had dug himself quite a hole in the dead cat's guts. Larry's empty stomach did a slow forward roll. He considered beeping the horn to scare it away for good, but the sleeping brownstones with their empty garbage cans standing sentinel duty daunted him. He slouched lower in the bucket seat so he wouldn't have to watch the rat eating breakfast. Just a bite, my good man, and then back to the subway system. Going out to Yankee Stadium this evening? Perhaps I'll see you, old chum. Although I really doubt that you'll see me. The front of the building had been defaced with spray can slogans, cryptic and ominous. Chico 116, Zorro 93, Little Abe number 1. When he had been a boy before his father died, this had been a good neighborhood. Two stone dogs had guarded the steps leading up to the double doors. A year before he took off for the coast, vandals had demolished the one on the right from the forepaws up. Now they were both entirely gone, except for one rear paw of the left dog. The body it had been called into creation to support had entirely vanished, perhaps decorating some Puerto Rican junkie's crash pad. Maybe Zorro 93 or Little Abe number 1 had taken it. Maybe the rats had carried it away to some deserted subway tunnel one dark night. For all he knew, maybe they had taken his mother along, too. He supposed he should at least climb the steps and make sure her name was still there under the apartment 15 mailbox, but he was too tired. No, he would just sit here and nod off, trusting to the last residue of reds in his system to wake him up around 7. Then he would go see if his mother still lived here. Maybe it would be best if she was gone. Maybe then he wouldn't even bother with the Yankees. Maybe he would just check into the Biltmore, sleep for 3 days, and then head back into the Golden West. In this light, in this drizzle, with his legs and head still throbbing from the bring-down, New York had all the charm of a dead whore. His mind began to drift away again, mulling over the last 9 weeks or so, trying to find some sort of key that would make everything clear, and explain how you could butt yourself against stone walls for 6 long years, playing the clubs, making demo tapes, doing sessions, the whole bit, and then suddenly make it in 9 weeks. Trying to get that straight in your mind was like trying to swallow a doorknob. There had to be an answer, he thought, an explanation that would allow him to reject the ugly notion that the whole thing had been a whim, a simple twist of fate, in Dylan's words. He dozed deeper, arms crossed on his chest, going over it, and mixed up in all of it was this new thing, like a low and sinister counterpoint. One note at the threshold of audibility played on a synthesizer, heard in a migrainy sort of way that acted on you like a premonition. The rat, digging into the dead cat's body. Munch, munch, just looking for something tasty here. It's the law of the jungle, my man. If you're in the trees, you got to swing. It had really started 18 months ago. He had been playing with the tattered remnants in a Berkeley club, and a man from Columbia had called. Not a biggie, just another toiler in the vinyl vineyards. Neil Diamond was thinking of recording one of his songs, a tune called Baby Can You Dig Your Man. Diamond was doing an album, all his own stuff except for an old Buddy Holly tune, Peggy Sue Got Married, and maybe this Larry Underwood tune. The question was, would Larry like to come up and cut a demo of the tune, then sit in on the session? Diamond wanted a second acoustic guitar, and he liked the tune a lot. Larry said yes. The session lasted 3 days. It was a good one. Larry met Neil Diamond, also Robbie Robertson, also Richard Perry. He got mention on the album's inner sleeve and got paid union scale, but Baby Can You Dig Your Man never made the album. On the second evening of the session, Diamond had come up with a new tune of his own, and that made the album instead.
"Well," the man from Columbia said, "that's too bad. It happens. Tell you what, why don't you cut the demo anyway? I'll see if there's anything I can do."
So Larry cut the demo and then found himself back out on the street. In L.A., times were hard. There were a few sessions, but not many. He finally got a job playing guitar in a supper club, crooning things like "Softly as I Leave You" and "Moon River," while elderly cats talked business and sucked up Italian food. He wrote the lyrics on scraps of notepaper because otherwise he tended to mix them up or forget them altogether, chording the tune while he went, trying to look suave like Tony Bennett vamping and feeling like an asshole. In elevators and supermarkets, he had become morbidly aware of the low Muzak that played constantly. Then, 9 weeks ago and out of the blue, the man from Columbia had called. They wanted to release his demo as a single. Could he come back in and back it? Sure, Larry said. He could do that. So he had gone into Columbia's L.A. studios on a Sunday afternoon, double-tracked his own voice on "Baby, Can You Dig Your Man" in about an hour, and then backed it with a song he had written for the Tattered Remnants, "Pocket Savior." The man from Columbia presented him with a check for $500 and a stinker of a contract that bound Larry to more than it did the record company. He shook Larry's hand, told him it was good to have him aboard, offered him a small pitying smile when Larry asked him how the single would be promoted, and then took his leave. It was too late to deposit the check, so Larry ran through his repertoire at Gino's with it in his pocket. Near the end of his first set, he sang a subdued version of "Baby, Can You Dig Your Man." The only person who noticed was Gino's proprietor, who told him to save the nigger bebop for the cleanup crew. 7 weeks ago, the man from Columbia called again and told him to go get a copy of Billboard. Larry ran. "Baby, Can You Dig Your Man" was one of three hot prospects for that week. Larry called the man from Columbia back, and he had asked Larry how he would like to lunch with some of the real biggies, to discuss the album. They were all pleased with the single, which was getting airplay in Detroit, Philadelphia, and Portland, Maine already. It looked as if it was going to catch. It had won a late-night Battle of the Sounds contest for four nights running on one Detroit soul station. No one seemed to know that Larry Underwood was white. He had gotten drunk at the luncheon and hardly noticed how his salmon tasted. No one seemed to mind that he had gotten loaded. One of the biggies said he wouldn't be surprised to see "Baby, Can You Dig Your Man" carry off a Grammy next year. It all rang gloriously in Larry's ears. He felt like a man in a dream, and going back to his apartment, he felt strangely sure that he would be hit by a truck, and that would end it all. The Columbia biggies had presented him with another check, this one for $2,500. When he got home, Larry picked up the telephone and began to make calls. The first one was to Mort Gino Green. Larry told him he'd have to find someone else to play Yellowbird while the customers ate his lousy undercooked pasta. Then he called everyone he could think of, including Barry Grieg of the Remnants. Then he went out and got standing up, falling down drunk. 5 weeks ago, the single had cracked Billboard's Hot 100, number 89, with a bullet. That was the week spring had really come to Los Angeles, and on a bright and sparkling May afternoon, with the building so white and the ocean so blue that you could knock your eyes out and send them rolling down your cheeks like marbles, he had heard his record on the radio for the first time. Three or four friends were there, including his current girl, and they were moderately done up on cocaine. Larry was coming out of the kitchenette and into the living room with a bag full of Toll House cookies when the familiar KLMT slogan, "New Music," came on. And then Larry had been transfixed by the sound of his own voice coming out of the Technics speakers. "I know I didn't say I was coming down. I know you didn't know I was here in town. But baby, you can tell me if anyone can. Baby, can you dig your man? He's a righteous man. Tell me, baby, can you dig your man?" "Jesus, that's me," he had said. He dropped the cookies onto the floor and then stood gape-mouthed and stone-flabbergasted as his friends applauded. 4 weeks ago, his tune had jumped to 73 on the Billboard chart. He began to feel as if he had been pushed rudely into an old-time silent movie, where everything was moving too fast. The phone rang off the hook. Columbia was screaming for the album, wanted to capitalize on the single's success. Some crazy rat's ass of an A&R man called three times in one day, telling him he had to get into Record One, not now but yesterday,
and record a remake of the McCoys' Hang on Sloopy as the follow-up.
Monster, this moron kept shouting. Only follow-up that's possible, Lair.
He had never met this guy, and already he wasn't even Larry, but Lair.
It'll be a monster. I mean a fucking monster.
Larry at last lost his patience and told the monster shouter that, given a choice between recording Hang on Sloopy and being tied down and receiving a Coca-Cola enema, he would pick the enema. Then he hung up. The train kept rolling just the same. Assurances that this could be the biggest record in 5 years poured into his dazed ears. Agents called by the dozen. They all sounded hungry. He began to take uppers, and it seemed to him that he heard his song everywhere. One Saturday morning he heard it on Soul Train, and spent the rest of the day trying to make himself believe that, yes, that had actually happened. It became suddenly hard to separate himself from Julie, the girl he had been dating since his gig at Chino's. She introduced him to all sorts of people, few of them people he really wanted to see. Her voice began to remind him of the prospective agents he heard over the telephone. In a long, loud, acrimonious argument, he split with her. She had screamed at him that his head would soon be too big to fit through a recording studio door, that he owed her $500 for dope, that he was the 1990s answer to Zager and Evans. She had threatened to kill herself. Afterward, Larry felt as if he had been through a long pillow fight in which all the pillows had been treated with low-grade poison gas. They had begun cutting the album 3 weeks ago, and Larry had withstood most of the for-your-own-good suggestions. He used what leeway the contract gave him. He got three of the tattered remnants, Barry Grieg, Al Spellman, and Johnny McCall, and two other musicians he had worked with in the past, Neil Goodman and Wayne Stuckey. They cut the album in 9 days, absolutely all the studio time they could get. Columbia seemed to want an album based on what they thought would be a 20-week career, beginning with Baby, Can You Dig Your Man? And ending with Hang on Sloopy. Larry wanted more. The album cover was a photo of Larry in an old-fashioned clawfoot tub full of suds. Written on the tiles above him in a Columbia secretary's lipstick were the words Pocket Savior and Larry Underwood. Columbia had wanted to call the album Baby, Can You Dig Your Man? But Larry absolutely balked, and they had finally settled for a Contains the Hit Single sticker on the shrink wrap. 2 weeks ago, the single hit number 47, and the party had started. He had rented a Malibu beach house for a month, and after that things got a little hazy. People wandered in and out, always more of them. He knew some, but mostly they were strangers. He could remember being huckstered by even more agents who wanted to further his great career. He could remember a girl who had bum-tripped and gone screaming down the bone-white beach as naked as a nuthatch. He could remember snorting coke and chasing it with tequila. He could remember being shaken awake on Saturday morning, it must have been a week or so ago, to hear Casey Kasem spin his record as a debut song at number 36 on American Top 40. He could remember taking a great many reds and, vaguely, dickering for the Datsun Z with a $4,000 royalty check that had come in the mail. And then, it was June 13th, 6 days ago, the day Wayne Stuckey asked Larry to go for a walk with him down the beach. It had only been 9 in the morning, but the stereo was on, both TVs, and it sounded like an orgy was going on in the basement playroom. Larry had been sitting in an overstuffed living room chair, wearing only underpants, and trying owlishly to get the sense from a Superboy comic book. He felt very alert, but none of the words seemed to connect to anything. There was no gestalt. A Wagner piece was thundering from the quad speakers, and Wayne had to shout 3 or 4 times to make himself understood. Then Larry nodded. He felt as if he could walk for miles. But when the sunlight struck Larry's eyeballs like needles, he suddenly changed his mind. No walk, uh-uh. His eyes had been turned into magnifying glasses, and soon the sun would shine through them long enough to set his brains on fire. His poor old brains felt tinder dry. Wayne, gripping his arm firmly, insisted. They went down to the beach, over the warming sand to the darker brown hardpack, and Larry decided it had been a pretty good idea after all. The deepening sound of the breakers coming home was soothing. A gull, working to gain altitude, hung straining in the blue sky like a sketched white letter M. Wayne tugged his arm firmly. Come on. Larry got all the miles he felt he could walk, except that he no longer felt that way.
He had an ugly headache, and his spine felt as if it had turned to glass. His eyeballs were pulsing, and his kidneys ached dully. An amphetamine hangover is not as painful as the morning after the night he got through a whole fifth of Four Roses, but it is not as pleasant as, say, bawling Raquel Welch would be. If he had another couple of uppers, he could climb neatly on top of this eight ball that wanted to run him down. He reached in his pocket to get them, and for the first time became aware that he was clad only in skivvies that had been fresh 3 days ago.
"Wayne, I want to go back. Let's walk a little more."
He thought that Wayne was looking at him strangely, with a mixture of exasperation and pity.
"No, man, I only got my shorts on. I'll get picked up for indecent exposure."
"On this part of the coast, you could wrap a bandana around your wing-wang and let your balls hang free and still not get picked up for indecent exposure. Come on, man."
"I'm tired," Larry said querulously.
He began to feel pissed at Wayne. This was Wayne's way of getting back at him, because Larry had a hit, and he, Wayne, only had a keyboard credit on the new album. He was no different than Julie. Everybody hated him now. Everyone had the knife out. His eyes blurred with easy tears.
"Come on, man," Wayne repeated, and they struck off up the beach again.
They had walked perhaps another mile when double cramps struck the big muscles in Larry's thighs. He screamed and collapsed onto the sand. It felt as if twin stilettos had been planted in his flesh at the same instant.
"Cramps!" he screamed. "Oh, man, cramps!"
Wayne squatted beside him and pulled his legs out straight. The agony hit again, and then Wayne went to work, hitting the knotted muscles, kneading them. At last, the oxygen-starved tissues began to loosen. Larry, who had been holding his breath, began to gasp.
"Oh, man," he said. "Thanks. That was bad."
"Sure," Wayne said, without much sympathy. "I bet it was, Larry. How are you now?"
"Okay. But let's just sit, huh? Then we'll go back."
"I want to talk to you. I had to get you out here, and I wanted you straight enough so you could understand what I was laying on you."
"What's that, Wayne?"
he thought. "Here it comes. The pitch."
But what Wayne said seemed so far from a pitch that for a moment he was back with a Superboy comic, trying to make sense of a six-word sentence.
"The party's got to end, Larry."
"Huh?"
"The party. When you go back, you pull all the plugs, give everybody their car keys, thank everyone for a lovely time, and see them out the front door. Get rid of them."
"I can't do that," Larry said, shocked.
"You better," Wayne said.
"But why, man? This party's just getting going."
"Larry, how much has Columbia paid you up front?"
"Why would you want to know?" Larry asked slyly.
"Do you think I want to suck you off, Larry? Think."
Larry thought, and with dawning bewilderment he realized there was no reason why Wayne Stuckey would want to put the arm on him. He hadn't really made it yet, was scuffling for jobs like most of the people who had helped Larry cut the album. But unlike most of them, Wayne came from a family with money, and he was on good terms with his people. Wayne's father owned half of the country's third-largest electronic games company, and the Stuckeys had a modestly palatial home in Bel Air. Bewildered, Larry realized that his own sudden good fortune probably looked like small bananas to Wayne.
"No, I guess not," he said gruffly. "I'm sorry, but it seems like every tin-horn cockroach chaser west of Las Vegas. So how much?"
Larry thought it over.
$7,000 up front, all told."
"They're paying you quarterly royalties on the single and biannually on the album?"
"Right."
Wayne nodded.
"They hold it until the eagle screams, the bastards."
"Cigarette?" Larry took one and cupped the end for a light.
"Do you know how much this party's costing you?"
"Sure,"
Larry said. "You didn't rent the house for less than $1,000.
"Yeah, that's right."
It had actually been $1,200 plus a $500 damage deposit. He had paid the deposit and half the month's rent, a total of $1,100 with $600 owing.
"How much for dope?" Wayne asked.
"Oh, man, you gotta have something. It's like cheese for Ritz crackers.
There was pot and there was coke. How much? Come on."
"The fucking DA," Larry said sulkily.
"$500 and $500.
And it was gone the second day.
"The hell it was," Larry said, startled. "I saw two bowls when we went out this morning, man. Most of it was gone, yeah, but..."
Man, don't you remember the deck?
Wayne's voice suddenly dropped into an amazingly good parody of Larry's own drawling voice.
Just put it on my tab, Dewey. Keep 'em full.
Larry looked at Wayne with dawning horror. He did remember a small, wiry guy with a peculiar haircut, a wiffle cut they had called it 10 or 15 years ago, a small guy with a wiffle haircut and a T-shirt reading Jesus is coming and is he pissed. This guy seemed to have good dope practically falling out of his asshole. He could even remember telling this guy, Dewey the Deck, to keep his hospitality bowls full and put it on his tab. But that had been, well, that had been days ago. Wayne said, "You're the best thing to happen to Dewey Deck in a long time, man."
"How much is he into me for?"
"Not bad on pot. Pot's cheap. 1,200. 8 grand on coke." For a minute, Larry thought he was going to puke. He goggled silently at Wayne. He tried to speak, and he could only mouth.
9,200?
"Inflation, man," Wayne said. "You want the rest?" Larry didn't want the rest, but he nodded. "There was a color TV upstairs. Someone ran a chair through it. I'd guess 300 for repairs. The wood paneling downstairs has been gouged to hell. 400, with luck. The picture window facing the beach got broken the day before yesterday. 300. The shag rug in the living room is totally kaput. Cigarette burns, beer, whiskey. 400. I called the liquor store, and they're just as happy with their tab as the deck is with his. 600.
600 for booze?
Larry whispered. Blue horror had encased him up to the neck. Be thankful most of them have been scoffing beer and wine. You've got a $400 tab down at the market. Mostly for pizza, chips, tacos, all that good shit. But the worst is the noise. Pretty soon the cops are going to land. Les flics. Disturbing the peace. And you've got 4 or 5 heavies doing up on heroin. There's 3 or 4 ounces of Mexican brown in the place.
Is that on my tab too?
Larry asked hoarsely. No, the deck doesn't mess with heroin. That's an organization item, and the deck doesn't like the idea of cement cowboy boots. But if the cops land, you can bet the bust will go on your tab.
But I didn't know just a babe in the woods, yeah.
But your total tab for this little shindy so far comes to over $12,000, Wayne said. You went out and picked that Z off the lot. How much did you put down?
25. Larry said numbly.
He felt like crying. So what have you got until the next royalty check? A couple thousand?
That's about right, Larry said,
unable to tell Wayne he had less than that. About 800, split evenly between cash and checking.
Larry, you listen to me because you're not worth telling twice. There's always a party waiting to happen. Out here the only two constants are the constant bullshitting and the constant party. They come running like dicky birds looking for bugs on a hippo's back. Now they're here. Pick them off your carcass and send them on their way.
Larry thought of the dozens of people in the house. He knew maybe one person in three at this point. The thought of telling all those unknown people to leave made his throat want to close up. He would lose their good opinion. Opposing this thought came an image of Dewey Deck refilling the hospitality bowls, taking a notebook from his back pocket and writing it all down at the bottom of his tab. Him and his wiffle haircut and his trendy T-shirt. Wayne watched him calmly as he squirmed between these two pictures.
"Man, I'm going to look like the asshole of the world," Larry said finally, hating the weak and petulant words as they fell from his mouth.
"Yeah, they'll call you a lot of names. They'll say you're going Hollywood, getting a big head, forgetting your old friends. Except none of them are your friends, Larry. Your friends saw what was happening 3 days ago and split the scene. It's no fun to watch a friend who's, like, pissed his pants and doesn't even know it."
"So why tell me?"
Larry asked, suddenly angry. The anger was prodded out of him by the realization that all his really good friends had taken off. And in retrospect, all their excuses seemed lame. Barry Grieg had taken him aside, had tried to talk to him, but Larry had been really flying, and he had just nodded and smiled indulgently at Barry. Now he wondered if Barry had been trying to lay the same rap on him. It made him embarrassed and angry to think so.
Why tell me? He repeated. I get the feeling you don't like me so very goddamn much.
No, but I really don't dislike you either. Beyond that, man, I couldn't say.